That binds Iran's top negotiator meets the envoys of the European signatories to the 2015 deal in Vienna, as talks continue on the removal of U.S. sanctions and Iran's commitment under the agreement. Kazakhstan's president says he's ordered troops to fire without warning in a bid to put down anti-government unrest. Nearly 230 more people have died of the novel coronavirus in the UK in the past day. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this hour, Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA continue the eighth round of talks to restore the agreement. Iranian lead negotiator Ali Bagherikani met representatives of the three European signatories to the deal in Vienna. Expert-level talks are also underway on the removal of U.S. sanctions on Iran and Tehran's return to full compliance with its commitments under the JCPOA. Iran and the P4+1 group have also been exchanging informal texts on ways to resolve outstanding issues. The other parties convey these texts to the U.S. delegation, which is participating in the talks indirectly. The U.S. withdrew from the agreement in 2018, reimposing sanctions on Iran. We were joined by our Vienna correspondent, Toma Lezgi, for an update on the eighth round of talks in the Austrian capital.
The eighth round of the talks aimed at restoring the JCPOA are still ongoing here in Vienna. And today you mentioned there was yet another meeting between Iran's team led by Mr. Bagheri and the European signatories of the JCPOA. We had a recent tweet from the Russian lead delegate, Mikhail Olyanov, during which he said that in a meeting that the 4+1- Iran had with the Americans, one of the most difficult issues on the agenda of the Vienna talks, he said, was discussed in a targeted discussion. He said, these are the words he used, a sign that indeed serious negotiations are underway on the key sticking points. Also, we heard from the Iranian foreign minister, I'm sure you've had in the news yourself, that talks are proceeding in the right direction. And the same sentiment we're hearing coming from the French foreign minister. In one interview, he said that progress has been made, although he has again made the point of time, saying that things have to be speeded up and we don't want to run out of time. And this is also a sentiment that we're hearing coming from the American side. But despite this, there are signs of progress. Sources close, at least European sources close to the negotiations, believe that most likely the scenario that they consider is that there is going to be an agreement. But of course, this doesn't mean that the sticking points have all been resolved, because they haven't. And they are, we're hearing, some technical, complex issues that need to be included in the final document. I'll just quickly say here, the two important issues for Iran when it comes to sanctions removal is guarantees and verification. And the European sources acknowledge that it is quite important that all the participants have agreed that these two issues should be reflected in one way or another in the final document. But the discussions now are how. For instance, how can you give guarantees, this specifically referring to the U.S., that Washington will not withdraw from the JCPOA again, will not reimpose sanctions in violation of the deal again?
Iran says that it remains ready to hold bilateral talks with concerned parties over the accidental downing of a Ukrainian passenger plane near Tehran 2 years ago. In a statement, the Iranian foreign ministry said three rounds of talks have already been held with the Ukrainian government on the measures taken on the matter. It warned, however, that some countries are trying to exploit the tragic incident. It said some reparations have already been paid, and Iran has already declared its readiness to make payments to the families of the foreign victims. Iran blames human error for the downing, as it anticipated a U.S. military attack hours before the incident. Iran had carried out missile strikes on a U.S. base in Iraq in retaliation for the assassination of its top commander, General Qasem Soleimani. The Taliban appeal for emergency humanitarian aid without, quote, political bias, saying the recent snow and flooding has worsened the plight of the Afghan people. Taliban's deputy prime minister says people do not have food accommodation and warm clothes in various places. Abdulghani Baradar says the world has an obligation to help Afghanistan. Since the Taliban seized control of Afghanistan in mid-August, billions of dollars of the country's assets have been frozen by the United States. Global aid agencies have warned that more than half of Afghanistan's 38 million people are expected to face hunger this winter. Snow has blanketed most of central and northern Afghanistan in recent days, while flooding has affected parts of the south. And Kazakhstan began the new year with a spike in fuel prices that triggered protests across the country. Now President Kasym-Jomart Tokayev says constitutional order has been mainly restored, but an ongoing operation will continue against what he calls terrorists.
The counter-terrorist operation continues. The militants have not laid down their arms. They continue to commit crimes or are preparing for them. The fight against them must be pursued to the end. Whoever does not surrender will be destroyed.
Tokayev says he has ordered security forces to open fire without warning in case of further unrest. He says up to 20,000 bandits have attacked the main city, Almaty, where they destroyed state property. The protests in Almaty and other Kazakh cities turned violent this week with clashes between protesters and security forces. The government says 44 people were killed. They included security forces and people whom the government called armed criminals. Thousands more were arrested. A regional peacekeeping force led by Russia is now in Kazakhstan to help it restore security. A group of British lawmakers have warned of a dangerous precedent being set after protesters who toppled the statue of 17th century slave trader Edward Colston walked free from a British court cleared of criminal damage charges. But supporters of the people dubbed the Colston Four says the case was politically motivated and should never have been brought in the first place. Amina Taylor has more.
Cleared of criminal damage charges at Bristol Crown Court, Rhiann Graham, Myla Ponsford, Jake Skuse, and Sage Willoughby, dubbed the Colston Four, celebrated their acquittal in a trial that's divided British public opinion. For those who had been on trial, relief and a sense of vindication.
We are ecstatic and stunned. I tried to write something ready for this moment, and I'm just so overwhelmed.
We didn't change history, we rectified history.
We illuminated history. They lied. We illuminated history.
And this is a victory for Bristol. This is a victory for racial equality.
And this is where it began, at a Black Lives Matter demonstration in Bristol in June 2020.
I think the courts accepted that this was almost a political show trial. That Boris Johnson and the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, had determined that they wanted to make an example of the Colston Four, and the courts rejected that.
The jury's verdict has garnered mixed reviews, with some MPs writing to the Attorney General, asking him to look once more at the wrong result. Elsewhere, there have been calls for the Home Secretary to explain why this case was so heavily pursued in the first place, and what happens now when that move has seemingly backfired.
The focus is now on high-profile monuments like the statue of Sir Winston Churchill, Britain's lauded World War II leader, but a figure that's being seen increasingly through the lens of his controversial views on race and empire.
New legislation being pushed through under the Police and Crime Bill will make defacing monuments punishable by up to 10 years behind bars. There is the hope that many local and national stakeholders will use the outcome of the Colston Four trial as a teachable moment, a chance to reflect on Britain's checkered past. But then again, maybe it will just be business as usual. Amina Taylor, London.
COVID-19 cases are surging across Europe, with many countries reporting more infections and deaths as the continent continues to grapple with the Omicron variant. The United Kingdom has reported over 178,000 new cases and nearly 230 fatalities in the past day. This comes days after the country registered a record rise in daily cases. Health officials blame the spike on the highly infectious Omicron variant. Multiple British hospitals have declared the situation critical. In Italy, officials have reported 223 more deaths from the disease. They've also logged over 108,000 new cases, which was less than half from a day earlier. This has been attributed to fewer people getting tested during the national holidays. COVID cases keep surging in India, where new daily infections hit a 7-month high. The country on Friday reported over 117,000 new cases. taking the total to more than 35 million. The rise in cases is driven by the Omicron variant, which is overtaking Delta. Last spring, Delta caused a surge that resulted in thousands of deaths each day. Now, experts worry that the current surge could again see hospitals overwhelmed. Authorities in several Indian cities have already brought in restrictions to keep infections in check. The capital, New Delhi, is under an overnight curfew. Will impose further restrictions for weekend later on Friday. India's total COVID deaths are about 483,000. Our correspondent in New Delhi, Munawar Zaman, says India needs stricter measures to tackle its ongoing wave of COVID infections.
There is again a problem with the mindset and the imagination that people are taking things for granted and things are being taken easily, despite and regardless of the fact that April was the deadliest. Last April, the country saw a deadliest period in its history. So there are many guidelines in place. There are many health emergencies and health protocols that have been decided and also put in place, but they need more stringent measures. Like we see in the public transport, people are overcrowding the buses, they are flouting all the protocols and guidelines, people are not wearing masks just to keep them on their chins, and the basic protocol is missing, so there's a lot to do.
Iran has reported 19 COVID-related deaths over the past day, the lowest daily toll in almost 2 years. The figure brings the overall fatalities to 132,000. More than 1,100 new infections were also registered, raising the total caseload to more than 6 million. COVID-related figures have been declining in Iran thanks to the country's mass vaccination campaign. Nearly 122 million jabs have so far been administered. That includes more than 60 million who have received their first dose. Some 52 million have also received a second dose, while almost 9.5 million have received a booster shot. The U.S. Labor Department says the country added almost 200,000 jobs in December. That is the United States' worst month of job creation in 2021. Economists had forecast a job growth of double that number. The slump is attributed to a surge of COVID-19 cases and reimposition of restrictions fueled by the highly contagious Omicron variant. The new strain has sickened millions of Americans and forced airlines to cancel thousands of flights. Many are also reluctant to go back to work. In 2021, the U.S. economy bounced back from the pandemic, but payrolls remain well below their pre-pandemic levels. U.S. employment is still more than 3 million jobs lower than it was in February 2020. The most recent missile test by North Korea was probably a reminder that Pyongyang does not intend to abandon its pursuit of advanced weapons. In the next report, we'll see why the North feels it needs to boost its defenses.
Just days into 2022, North Korea carried out a major weapons test. It launched a hypersonic missile this week, with North Korean media saying the projectile precisely hit its target at a distance of 700 kilometers. This was North Korea's second test of a hypersonic missile. Unlike ballistic missiles that fly up into outer space before returning to hit their targets with a somehow predictable trajectory, hypersonic weapons fly at lower altitudes and can achieve more than 5 times the speed of sound. Analysts say, however, the main feature of hypersonic weapons is not their speed, but their maneuverability makes them much harder to detect by radar. The North is currently part of a small group of countries, including the United States and China, in trying to develop hypersonic military technologies.
They have a plan. They have a plan that is public, is available, public, is not, there is no secret, is available. And so they have several devices, several weapon range that they want to develop. And one category is the hypersonic one.
The latest test firing came days after North's leader Kim Jong-un pledged once again to boost Pyongyang's defenses. He said in a New Year's speech that Pyongyang would continue to strengthen its capabilities because the Korean Peninsula still faces an increasingly unstable military environment. North Korea tested different projectiles last year amid stalled talks with the United States and its southern neighbor. Under former U.S. President Donald Trump, America and North Korea came close to a conflict before a series of meetings between the two adversaries' presidents. The high-profile summits broke down with no agreement, making Trump's approach towards North Korea another one of his major failures.
The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden insists that it's open to dialogue with North Korea. But Pyongyang seems to have learned a lesson from Trump's era and his futile attempts at détente. Pyongyang has described American diplomatic overtures as empty rhetoric without meaningful changes to hostile policies, including war games close to its borders and economic sanctions.
North Korea has been subjected to Western sanctions for decades. Its relationship with the U.S. and its southern neighbors, South Korea and Japan, both staunch American allies, has been fraught with tensions for a very long time. North Korea is grappling with economic sanctions and chronic food shortages. Pyongyang has suffered under sanctions, but it has somehow managed to withstand the American pressure campaign.
The manager to avoid any trouble to their economy in the same way that many other countries that are under sanction they're doing. So basically they readjust their economy in a way that they can survive.
Despite its long list of economic problems, the North has managed to produce several nuclear warheads, describing them as a necessary insurance against an attack by the U.S. The U.S., which has been calling on North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons, has left no stone unturned to isolate the communist state. But successive U.S. administrations have failed to force North Korea into submission. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration now says it is open to talks, but the North says that's implausible given the record of American hostile policies. The North seems too weary of American ulterior motives. What if it abandons its atomic arms and the U.S. does not drop its hostile policies and keeps up the pressure? This must be one of the key questions that comes to the North Korean leader's mind when he focuses on his country's relationship with America. The North insists that the White House has been determined to take and reluctant to give during past talks. It remains to be seen how Biden will act now to try to ease tensions on the Korean Peninsula.
That's it with the world news for now. Do stay tuned. Bye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The House Committee investigating the 6th of January attack on the Capitol has requested that Sean Hannity, the star of Fox News host, respond to questions about his communications with former President Donald J. Trump and his staff in the days surrounding the riot. The article you're about to hear has been written by Michael Grimbaum and Luke Broadwater. The piece is titled, House Panel Asks Sean Hannity of Fox News to Cooperate in 6th of January Inquiry. The House Committee investigating the 6th of January attack on the Capitol has requested that Sean Hannity, the star of Fox News host, respond to questions about his communications with former President Donald J. Trump and his staff in the days surrounding the riot. In a letter on Tuesday, 4th of January, the committee asked for Mr. Hannity's voluntary cooperation, meaning that the host has not received a formal subpoena. The letter detailed a series of text messages between the conservative media star and senior officials in the Trump White House, illustrating Sean Hannity's unusually elevated role as an outside advisor to the Trump administration. The text suggests that Sean Hannity was aware of and deeply concerned about what Donald Trump was planning for 6th of January, and bracing for a possible mass resignation of top White House lawyers as a result. We can't lose the entire White House counsel's office, Sean Hannity wrote to Mark Meadows, the White House chief of staff at the time, in a 31st of December 2020 text message that the committee included in its letter. I do not see 6th of January happening the way he's being told, Hannity said. They also indicate that the Fox News host, a longtime confidant of the former president, had knowledge of a flurry of high-level conversations at the White House involving Donald Trump himself about leaning on Vice President Mike Pence to use his ceremonial role in Congress's official electoral count to keep Donald Trump in office. Pence pressure, Sean Hannity wrote in a 5th of January message, White House counsel will leave. The texts were included in a trove of 9,000 pages of documents that Mark Meadows turned over to the panel in response to a subpoena. As Donald Trump grappled with the political fallout of the attack, including a looming impeachment inquiry and rebukes from some top Republicans, Sean Hannity wrote on 10th of January to Mark Meadows and Representative Jim Jordan, an Ohio Republican and a key ally. Sean Hannity wrote, "He can't mention the election again, ever," Sean Hannity said in the message, referring to Donald Trump. "I did not have a good call with him today. And worse, I'm not sure what is left to do or say, and I don't like not knowing if it's truly understood." Ideas? A lawyer for Sean Hannity, Jay Sekulow, said on Tuesday that the committee's request would raise serious constitutional issues, including First Amendment concerns regarding freedom of the press. Fox News referred inquiries to Jay Sekulow's statement. The letter from the committee informed Sean Hannity that it believed the Fox News host had advanced knowledge regarding President Trump's and his legal team's planning for 6th of January, calling him a fact witness in our investigation. The committee wrote that it had obtained dozens of text messages between Sean Hannity and members of Donald Trump's inner circle, including a note on 5th of January in which Sean Hannity expressed concern about the next day's counting of Electoral College votes. "I'm very worried about the next 48 hours," Sean Hannity wrote. Mr. Hannity was one of several Fox News stars who became informal confidants to Donald Trump over the course of his administration, frequently conversing with the president by telephone and over meals in the White House. He was more than a Fox host, he was also a confidant, advisor, campaigner for the former president, Representative Adam Schiff, a California Democrat and member of the committee, said on MSNBC on Tuesday, 4th of January. Last month, the committee revealed that Sean Hannity had contacted Mark Meadows on 6th of January as rioters overtook the Capitol, asking, "Can he make a statement? Ask people to leave the Capitol." The Fox News stars Laura Ingraham and Brian Kilmeade sent similar notes asking that Donald Trump take steps to quell the violence. In Fox News primetime on 6th of January, Sean Hannity told his viewers that all of today's perpetrators must be arrested and prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, adding, "Every good and decent American we know will and must condemn what happened at the Capitol." A spokesman for the committee declined to say on Tuesday if additional Fox News hosts would be asked to answer questions. Sean Hannity is the most prominent media star so far that the committee has contacted about testifying. The committee previously issued a subpoena for the conspiracy theorist and InfoWars host Alex Jones, who has sued the committee to try to stonewall the investigation. The letter to Sean Hannity was signed by Representative Benny Thompson, Democrat of Mississippi, and the committee chairman, and also its vice chairwoman, Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming. "We have no doubt that you'd love our country and respect our Constitution," Benny Thompson and Liz Cheney wrote. "Now is the time to step forward and serve the interests of your country." Meanwhile, former President Donald Trump on Tuesday, 4th of January, abruptly cancelled a news conference that he had scheduled at his Mar-a-Lago resort for Thursday evening, 6th of January, on the one-year anniversary of the breaching of the United States Capitol. Donald Trump's initial decision on 30th of December to counter-program the remembrance events to be held on Capitol Hill had drawn immediate concern from Republicans and allies, who questioned the wisdom of his seizing the spotlight for himself, saying it would be a needless and harmful distraction. Republicans, including Donald Trump in a statement on Tuesday, 4th of January, have tried to divert attention from the fact that it was the former president's supporters who turned violent as they sought to stall the certification of the 2020 presidential election and to falsely blame House Speaker Nancy Pelosi for the violence. Donald Trump's encouraging speech to supporters on 6th of January 2021, delivered shortly before the riot, was the centerpiece of his second impeachment by the Democratic-led House of Representatives. He was acquitted by the Senate when it failed to reach a two-thirds majority to convict him of incitement of insurrection. In his statement, Donald Trump faulted both the media and the ongoing House investigation into the assault on the Capitol for his cancellation, but said he would discuss many of those important topics at a rally he's planning to hold on 15th of January in Arizona. Oh,
is back to reality. Back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality, where we discuss various topics and then bring you back to reality. I'm your humble host, Muzaffar Haider. Here in the studio today, we have with us my main man, Brother Ja'far. Assalamu alaikum to you, brother.
Alaikum salam. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you. We go way back. And we have Sister Zainab. Assalamu alaikum, Sister Zainab.
Alaikum assalam.
Where are you from?
I'm from Indian administrated Kashmir.
It seems like racism in this dark world all around us is increasing. What is going on? It should have decreased. It should have become lesser. After all of the great personalities that we've had throughout our history, we've had Shaheed Malcolm X, may Allah bless his soul. We've had people like Martin Luther King. We've had people like Nelson Mandela. We've had, going further and further back, even the great personalities of Islam itself. And Islam has promoted so heavily the emphasis on, look, you are one united brotherhood, humanity is the best of races. And yet, you know, racism is increasing. What is going on? Why is this happening?
In my opinion, what I think the reason behind the rise in racism is this whole concept of me, that I'm better than you. I need to show my authority over you, so I'm gonna, in a sense, demean you, make you feel like nothing. Take any, I guess, power or authority that you have and nullify it completely.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The whole basis of the U.S. coming into existence was the killing of the indigenous people. Right? Because in their eyes, in the eyes of the Europeans that came over, they were nothing. These are people who used to throw rocks and had slings compared to the Europeans who came in with artillery and weapons. Right? In their eyes, because they were more advanced, they thought, okay, we're better than you. You have to work for us. It shouldn't be the other way around. Like, dare you say that, you know, we're lesser beings than you.
So you're saying racism is closely linked to colonialism and imperialism?
Yes.
So it is essentially bullying. And actually, you defined racism quite correctly right there, because it is about, in a nutshell, one race deeming itself to be superior to another race.
Exactly. So you have many examples throughout history where, suppose, in whichever holy book it was written, oh, God's talking about us. We're the guys. The rest of you, you're at a lower stage, right? So I guess the basis of racism came from that. Instead of looking at one another as equals, what we're trying to do is we say, look, we're better than you, so you have to subject to us.
Yeah.
But in reality, we should all be subjecting to God as one, right? As one, suppose, group, as one set of like pieces in the basis of the world, right? As humankind in completion here, you should all be subjecting to God.
Yeah.
Not one another saying, oh, look, I got something that you don't. Because we all have our weaknesses. I don't think any group of people can say, oh, look, we're the best and we have no weaknesses. That's only God.
Sister Zainab, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think we have a proverb in our local language, in Kashmiri language, which means that empty drums make much noise.
Uh-huh.
So I think this superiority complex kind of thing comes into this. Something that's behind racism is superiority complex. And this superiority complex comes into the minds of these empty drums. The brothers said, kneel off the bottom. I went there and they were kneel off the bottom. They were nothing. When these people feel endangered, they get this complex that I am something, I am someone. But the more knowledge you have, you actually have, the more you're filled. If you're a filled drum, you will make much less noise. We have example of like, if we have a tree that bears more fruits, it is more down towards earth. And like, I guess the basic idea that's behind racism is superiority complex based on nothing, based on that empty drum.
And that's why it's increasing, actually, because these empty drums are making much, much more noise, their message is reaching further and to more people. I mean, I guess the racist ideas are easier to talk about. And when I say that, I have to be careful because people will think that I'm referring to blatant racism. I'm not. I'm talking about the subtle racism which exists throughout mainstream media. It's just the hegemonic idea of, for example, the white race being superior. You know, that hegemonic idea, which is unavoidable. You can't really escape from it. Wherever you look, you'll see the kind of white savior complex or themes of that nature shining through. Now what we're seeing is a backlash against the recognition of that, where white people are saying, well, I'm being targeted too. I'm being told that I'm inherently evil because I'm white. And they're right, because that is what some people are espousing. So racism is going both ways.
I think the words that you used right now, right? Yeah. You said white people. You've already separated a group of people just based on what? On
color.
The way that they look. Mm. On like what they speak, right? But in the Quran it shows that, look, all people are one of the same.
Except for taqwa.
Yeah. That we're all at the same level here, right? But what society has done now, and it's obviously getting worse, you're understanding a group or a culture through physical attributes.
We're speaking about... It seems like racism in this dark world all around us is increasing.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
See, okay, so do you believe that we should be colorblind? Because lots of people say that, you know, I'm colorblind. You look like a white person to me, even if there's a black person standing in front of them, right? And they'll be like, you know, I don't see you as brown. I see you as the same as me. But I'm not the same as you. I am different, you know. So should we be colorblind?
I'm saying there's a lack of understanding between people.
Right.
That results in us labeling people this or that, depending on what we deem is okay and what we deem is not okay.
Yeah.
Right? Because the whole concept of racism came from, I guess you could say, it came from one group thinking, okay, look, these people were nice to me, so, you know, we're going to give them some respect.
Yeah.
These people, you know, they didn't help me out as much, so we're going to drop their level a bit.
Uh-huh.
Right? And that spread throughout history to an extent where now you have a group of people from a certain part of the world and they're deemed better, but with no basis behind it. It's just because of where they're from, what language they speak, the color of their skin, they have this quote-unquote superiority over someone who doesn't have these qualities.
Yeah.
But there's no basis behind, like, there's no difference. If you really look at these two people, there's no, like, substantial difference between the two.
So the Holy Quran says, يَا أَيُّهَا النَّاسُ إِنَّ خَلَقْنَاكُمْ مِنْ ذَكَرٍ وَأُنْثَى وَجَعَلْنَاكُمْ شُعُوبًا وَقَبَائِلَ لِتَعَارَفُوا. I find that so beautiful. So it says, O mankind, we've created you into male and female and into groups and tribes so that you may know one another. So in other words, there are differences between you. Yes, you do have different colors, different skins, different genders. You know, you are all different. And we've done this so that you can recognize each other. Recognize. I think that a big part of the problem is the recognition is not there. There are certain people who are discriminated against because of the color of their skin. We have to try to feel that pain that those minority groups are feeling, whatever color they might be. But the next part of the verse is even more beautiful. It says, "Inna akramakum 'indallah atqakum." Surely the best of you with Allah are those who have the most taqwa, those who
are
always
the most
struggle
pious.
To find a
the most pious,
yeah, the most pious, those who fear Allah the most, or those who refrain from doing bad things.
When you perform the obligatory things and you avoid the what is forbidden,
yeah.
So that way you become more pious, and if you know you are obeying Allah, you are.
So it doesn't matter which tribe or nation.
It doesn't
you belong
matter.
To.
You know, it's we as human beings. It's beyond our imagination. We have divided ourselves on the basis of physical features, mm-hmm. basically, and dividing ourselves on the basis of physical features, we fail to understand the other person's, you know, inner side. And that's what Allah was saying in the same verse, that, you know, I want you to recognize each other, not on the basis of physical features. As long as I am not going to listen to a person, I cannot understand him. I cannot understand someone on the basis of his color, on the basis of his height, on the basis of someone else. These are the divisions, these are the, you know, racist things that we developed. And thanks to media techniques for that. We use so many media techniques in order to make a thing very bold, like a media technique called Big Lie. There's a media technique called Big Lie, and this so much works. For example, this technique was used by the United States while it was in war with Russia, I guess. I think. They said that Neil Armstrong went to moon, while as he never went to moon. No country was ever able to send anyone to moon. Did you know that? Yeah. So that's a big lie, but it worked. Yeah. It worked at that time. You know, it took US to some, you know.
Yeah, back then, though, they actually had a phone conversation live, and it was live broadcasted to between the man on the moon and the president of the United States, and everybody was watching it live, and the president was picking up the phone, and he's like, oh, so you're on the moon? Congratulations. And then the guy who was apparently on the moon was talking back, and people just believed it.
And yeah, like, if I go to K2 mountain and I want to call home, I don't get signals, but I get signals on moon. That's amazing.
That defeats the whole purpose. If you can't get a signal here, how are you going to get a signal somewhere else?
Exactly.
That's outside of
it's like they basis suddenly of the erected telephone lines on the moon.
You got to go to the moon to find out.
It is so crazy. We'll be right back.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Media techniques that are being used to, you know, highlight an idea, they work a lot.
Absolutely,
they work on your mind, they work on your thoughts, they change your thoughts.
You've highlighted such a good point here, because it is about that big lie. Big lie, right? The thing. So if you tell a small lie, people might reject it. But if you tell a really big lie, people are more likely to believe it. That's the general idea. Really big, like 9/11, right? That kind of big. You tell it, people are going to buy it, because the human mind can't comprehend that somebody would lie that much.
To such an extent.
Right?
Exactly.
But the idea here, bringing it back to racism, is the man landing on the moon, it was at the end of the day a white man, right? And so it plays into the narrative of, look, they are the dominant, better people. They are able to do things which you can't
you
do.
You cannot.
Right? You know, they are the pioneers of the greatest sciences of the world, and they have lots of heroes and political figures as well, who we all look up to and think that they are the actual people who change the destiny of humanity.
You even look at, suppose, like children's shows. What do they teach children from a young age? Look, the hero is a white man, right? The area where he's from is a majority white, right? If you're colored, if you are from a different area, you have a different language, society doesn't accept you for who you are. You have to strive to be like the white man, right? Yeah. Any hero they've made for children, they're all white, right? Even like movies nowadays, the main character is white.
Yeah.
Just to push that idea that, look, what the white man can do isn't like at the same level, it's not on par with something a minority group, someone from a minority group.
It comes down to the whole idea of like scientific racism, the whole idea of eugenics, because they actually did promote the idea that certain races are better at certain things. So the white race is better at leadership. You, as a brown person, for example, you are better at driving a taxi. You're good at that. You're hardworking, and that's a good thing. If you're a black person, you're better at crime. You are better at that.
They justified their own beliefs here,
right?
And they've really pushed it, and they've taken it to such an extent where even someone who isn't accustomed to that just accepts it now. No one fights against this thing anymore.
Really interesting discussion that we've had, and we've barely even scratched the surface, but unfortunately we're out of time. From myself, from Sayyid Ja'far, and from Sister Zainab, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Rabbi, let the ummah rise. زكاة
يا الله
يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي التي أمارا زكاة لتصي دليلتك وانسكا
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website. www.parstoday.com/en
Limelight.
According to a major 2019 study, from 2001 to 2019, taxpayers incurred a cost of $6.4 trillion for U.S. wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Pakistan. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Lipton Matthews, writer. This article is published under the heading America's wars are far more costly than the Pentagon admits. Stay tuned for more. America's decision to withdraw troops from Afghanistan was greeted with disdain in some quarters, but so far most pundits have explored this debacle from the vantage point of foreign affairs by either lamenting the decline of American influence or lauding the move as a justified containment of an aggressive foreign policy. Both views are worth pondering, however. Afghanistan and other foreign policy failures should spark a broader debate on the economics of war. America's engagement in war has proven to be quite costly. According to a major 2019 study from 2001 to 2019, taxpayers incurred a cost of $6.4 trillion for U.S. wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Pakistan. A key finding of the report is that the total budgetary burden of the post-9/11 wars will continue to balloon as the American government remains committed to interest payments and funding the rising expenses of veteran care. Further, estimates compiled by the Pentagon suggest that the military escapades of the U.S. have cost each taxpayer $7,623. Invariably, international bankers and defense contractors benefit from wars, though in the long run, war reverberates throughout the economy. Yet despite the cost of warfare, the idea that wars drive innovation is still widely promulgated. This argument has some merit because history demonstrates that the demands of wartime have spurred innovations like penicillin, electronic computers, and a radar. Innovations birthed by the pangs of warfare can serve a useful commercial function. However, on the flip side, warfare diverts the attention of the sharpest minds from solving scientific and commercial problems to crafting solutions aimed at destroying life. According to Nathan Rosenberg, during the Industrial Revolution, the quest to solve commercial problems led to the emergence of novel products. So, in the absence of war, the potential of scientists is deployed to more productive use. While warfare has resulted in notable inventions, we will never know the industrial innovations that were never conceptualized because engineers and scientists were busy aiding the military-industrial complex. On the basis that involvement in the Second World War stimulated scientific research, economists Daniel Gross and Behaven Sampat include in a recent report that war-related efforts led to the emergence of technology clusters. Some might mistake this deduction as evidence for the innovation-inducing effects of warfare. Doing so, however, is premature, since there is no guarantee that applications designed to conduct warfare will be germane to industry. The building of military technology is not motivated by a desire to enhance the utility of consumers or create scientific breakthroughs. Such developments are therefore coincidental. Indeed, commercially viable inventions wrought by warfare must be celebrated. But there is a possibility that these innovations are Medicare substitutes for the actual products that would have been created had investors been laboring to create commercial or scientific value. Moreover, the innovation effect of the world wars could be contingent on time. 20th century wars produced superior inventions due to institutional quality and access to a sophisticated body of scientific research. Similarly, because sectoral linkages were more robust, recognizing connections across industries became a sensible business strategy. Readers may contend that this thesis is vitiated by Jeffrey Packer's audacious text, The Military Revolution, Military Innovation, and the Rise of the West. But the two theses complement each other. Packer's landmark study is just one text in a stream of studies aiming to provide an answer for the rise of Western civilization. To arrive at his conclusion, Packer had to interrogate multiple facets of European history and culture. Other regions duly engaged in ferocious battles, but their conflicts did not lead to a profound transformation in the art of war and military technology. Europeans built a project dedicated to maximizing the efficiency of warfare by updating technology, whereas institutions of a similar caliber elsewhere were non-existent. The innovations induced by warfare are determined by the expertise and agenda of those waging war. Always remember that gunpowder was invented in a country, but its full potential was actualized in the Western countries. Likewise, economic analysis disputes the narrative that America's participation in the Second World War laid the basis for post-war economic growth. Instead, the evidence shows that America's insertion in the war crippled productivity in the manufacturing sector. Alexander J. Field explains, between 1941 and 1948, total factor productivity within manufacturing declined. Considering the effects on TFP, the labor force, and the physical capital stock, the impact of the Second World War on the level and trajectory of U.S. potential output following the war was, on balance, almost certainly negative. Additionally, warfare entails The diminution of consumer welfare. Taxes extracted from hapless citizens to finance military expenses could have been invested, saved, or spent on commodities to increase the utility of consumers. An economy is judged based on its capacity to enhance the utility of consumers, and the war economy fails in this regard when taxes decrease utility by diminishing resources available to citizens. Meanwhile, applying the law of unseen costs to the government, it becomes obvious that expenditure on war limits the availability of resources for critical sectors like healthcare and education. By expending resources on fruitless wars, politicians indicate that their pro-poor rhetoric is empty talk. However, in documenting the effects of war, we should remind readers that trauma inflicted on the battleground negatively affects the well-being of combatants. After returning home, many ex-soldiers suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. Victims of post-traumatic stress disorder find it challenging to reintegrate into society and struggle to maintain social connections. Their inability to adjust to post-war life affects productivity and employability. Unfortunately, the damages sustained by some veterans preclude them from working. The burden of post-traumatic stress disorder compounded by physical ailments entails a stressful environment for American families. Hence, the effects of warfare ripple throughout society because the depressed state of veterans can adversely affect the well-being of family members. Caring for ailing veterans is costly even when they receive philanthropic and governmental support. As such, doing so is likely to deplete scarce resources. Such circumstances regress the productivity of people associated with veterans and restrain the supply of labor when employees exit the labor market to nurse relatives. Lastly, in according for the effects of war, it must be noted that affected veterans put additional strain on the health sector, minimizing the quality of care that could be provided to other patients in their absence. Politicians and intellectuals may project the rhetoric that wars are in the long-term interest, but the facts reveal that, on average, their results are deleterious to the utility and well-being of citizens.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.